Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello and welcome to This Is Your Laugh, the podcast that interviews well-known female stand-ups and comedy actors about what comedy has taught them about life. This podcast is brought to you by ITV Comedy 50/50, and we're your hosts, Roxy and Alice. Our guest today is actress Dune McKeachan. Her TV credits are genuinely too innumerable to list in entirety, but to quickly whiz off a few, she's played Jane Plough in Toast of London, Flavia or Flavia in Plebs, Kathy in Two Doors Down, Archangel Michael in Good Omens, Sarah in Pure, and of course, probably most famously, she wrote and starred in Channel 4's cult comedy series Smack the Pony alongside Sally Phillips and Fiona Allen.
Her radio credits are as long as the Great Wall of China, in which she's... I love that line, Roxy.
That's
wanted me to
turn
cut it, but I insisted. In which she's acted, narrated and presented, and she's also appeared in films too. Shout out to The Borrowers.
Oh my God, yes.
Such a great film. She's recently been seen treading the boards in David Mamet's Bitter Wheat at the Garrick Theatre, also starring John Malkovich, and before that was in Twelfth Night at the National Theatre. She's graced the stages of the Royal Court, the Alameda, and basically all the other theatres you've ever heard of in the UK. Dune McKeachan, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hello. Marvellous. I like my little tag here. It says Dune McCain.
Oh,
D-U-N-E.
This is brilliant.
McCain like the oven chips. So this is going on my fridge because I have so many brilliant mispronunciations of my name. Don Mackie Chan is the character. That's who I am at the doctor's. Like Jackie Chan, I'm Don Mackie Chan.
What's your medical record? Say Don Mackie Chan.
Don Mackie Chan.
This is great though, because if you want to go like, you know, incognito or whatever.
Yeah, off grid.
Wife of Jackie.
Yeah, so that's it. This is really good. I'm Dune McCain. Welcome, Dune McCain.
They do have a habit of doing that. Alice, we must have recorded, 10 episodes by now, and today is the first day that Alice's name has been spelled correctly.
The first day. Okay. I've had all sorts of things. I won't go into them, but like some of them are barely recognisable.
Don Mackie Chan, either.
Don Mackie Chan is so good.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah. So look, we should say, we've only just found this out. This is Dune's very first ever podcast.
And also Dune doesn't necessarily know what a podcast is.
I don't know what a podcast is. Well, I've never heard one. So when does it go out?
Well, that is to be determined, but possibly in the next few weeks.
And which frequency on the FM dial can I find it? Is it pirate?
So it's on the wind-up radio.
Okay.
And it's on...
it's not in that
on
SoundCloud that I can never find anything
in.
Oh,
God, no. It is on, Apple, a podcast app thing.
See, I don't have a computer.
Right. Oh, my
you
God,
really?
Do?
No.
Oh, how do you write?
So I have a phone. I write longhand.
Oh, dear.
That's why these nails I have to be taken off, because I can't hold my pen.
Oh, my God.
So
patience of a saint.
We had Dawn French on this podcast, and she's exactly the same, longhand. And
yes.
We just said, God, if there's a fire, you lock up your, you know, make sure you've got it in a safe
yeah,
somewhere.
Like flambard it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Do you keep yours somewhere very, very safe?
What, my what?
Your work.
I've got so many books, ridiculous, you know, different journals and books and leather-bound things that I never write in because they're too... pretty.
Yes.
And full of gorgeous waxy paper. And then, yeah, there's a lot of... I've left them at where I'm writing today in the library. I've got my daughter's old sort of A4. I don't like writing online, so I like having blank paper because then I can do pictures. And so it's a bit more like a mind map. If you have a... The best thing is those big pieces of lining paper where you can draw pictures. And then you can... sort of like, well, if you're writing a screenplay or something, you can write characters and, but if, as I'm trying to do now, writing a feminist memoir,
ooh,
that's really hard because you go, oh, I don't want it to be linear. I'm not gonna go, and then I went to the RSC,
yeah,
and then I went to the Nash. I'm not quite sure whether I can do it, so I'm practicing.
Oh, the lights just went off. Ominous.
Oh, suddenly disco lights.
Because it's for explaining, Alice, because we all just went, ooh.
Hey, maybe it's because it's Halloween.
Yeah. I think we maybe leave it like this. Mood lighting.
It's good. It's not, listeners, it's not pitch black.
No, very good.
But it's very good mood lighting.
Look at you getting the hang of doing podcasts, explaining the visuals.
I was going to make some jokes about being inappropriately touched in the dark, but now...
Let's not do girls touching.
Let's not do it. Let's not do it.
Because then the podcast will go
in a very different direction.
Exactly. Some sort of underground dark web.
Yeah. No, June, I want to say, I think it's so brave, though, to come on a podcast not knowing what podcast is. So
yeah.
I find that admirable. Well, well done, and thank you.
Well, I don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying, you know.
It's just a chat, isn't it?
It's just a chat. It's just a chat. There's no expectation.
It's somehow the new thing, though, isn't it? Because everyone goes... Oh, have you heard so-and-so's podcast? Have you not heard this podcast? And I'm podcast. Mm. Well, is it sort of like, what is it?
It's just a way of like...
So it's like a radio show. You're making your own radio show.
Essentially, Dune, let's be really honest about it. It's a way of supplementing your career.
Is it?
No. It's like, I'm a writer, but I'll also have a podcast.
And I'm a broadcaster and a podcast. Am I a podcaster?
I would probably say you're a podcast guest, and if you have your own podcast, you're a podcaster.
I'm a female podcaster. Mm.
Exactly.
I mean, some people are amazing and do it as their full-time thing.
Yeah.
But I think most people have it as a sideline to another job.
You can't get on the radio.
Hey.
Hey. Is that what it's all
about?
We're
looking at failed radio DJs here.
Yeah.
We could just go on Loose Women, but we don't want to.
No.
So we're going to do a podcast.
We're going to do a podcast.
Okay, I get it. Yeah. Okay, I'm with you, girls. I'm with you.
We will obviously talk about your work, but I feel like just from the few little things that I've picked up on now, so you don't have a computer, you don't listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
Are you very... I feel like you'd be very mentally healthy. Like, do you live a very un-technology life, essentially?
Mm.
I don't have... I'm not on social media. Which I think is very important.
Yeah.
Mm. And I encourage all my friends to come off it. And when they do, I take it as a personal victory. I do have a small phone that I can do emails on. So that's not that new, but it's new-ish. So I can send emails because my agent gets very cross when he has to send paper. So everyone has to send me letters. I love getting letters.
Oh, yes,
I love
so
getting
nice.
Cards. I like getting scripts. I'm a bit old-fashioned, so I'm slightly standing with a flag on the, you know, the diminishing Arctic of the old days.
I love that.
And going, well, this is how I want to be because I think it's healthier.
I want that.
I want that too.
Okay, I'm going to make you come off your social media.
How
then.
Do you enforce it?
I feel like our agents will just be like, we're not sending you a script. We don't have that power.
Also, Roxy, let's be honest.
Yeah.
How often do we
you're
get
right, I just need the sides for the part I don't get. You're right. I don't need the actual script.
Oh, they could send you the sides.
Yeah, exactly.
That's annoying when they send you the sides. And I'm trying to read it on my tiny phone. And I'm like, can they send it? So often I turn up at auditions and I have got no idea what I'm going in for. And that can either make people very cross or quite refreshed.
Well, I was
going
to say, you've been very successful with that approach. So perhaps we should all adopt it.
Yes, that could be a way of, yes. I remember going to a spa once and seeing this very, very expensive black truffle cream quite high up, spotlit. High up. And of course then there was all the other creams that were like, you know, daily scrub and sort of breakfast smoothie, and I was like, I don't want that. I want the black truffle cream that was £85. Now what is it that makes us want the spotlit? Is it just the packaging? Is it so from then on I put my fees up. I kind of doubled my fees.
So you'd have the cream.
Yeah, so I'm the black truffle cream. So I could have the cream and so I could get paid more.
And how's the cream been?
Well, cream, I still haven't quite managed to afford to buy it.
Oh, what?
No, I steal it from when I can climb up on a stepladder and get it. But the point being, as women, we often don't ask for enough.
Mm.
And be ready to walk away. That's quite hard. Maybe I have reached a point where I can say, do you know what? I'm not going to do that. People are like, what? You go, well, you might have to double that. Well, I have lost jobs, but also my life with my family is important. My time, I work to buy time.
Yeah.
Away from, so that in a way that can be, women are very afraid of asking for more because they think it's greedy and unacceptable. So I would say go for the black truffle cream.
I fully advocate that. How many times have you lost the job more than the times that they've said, yeah, fine, we'll just double your pay and you can have it?
I had a particularly horrific audition, and I came out of the American church setting off all the fire alarms with both my middle fingers in the air.
Wow.
It was so horrible. I felt so the poor girl who was filming me was bright red. The director, who will remain nameless, just kept making me sort of do it again and again. A, I hate being filmed and I hate reading anyway. I just like, I'll meet you for a cup of tea and let's talk about it. And obviously, if it's a really difficult, interesting part, then yes, let's read and work together. But it's the power thing that I hate. So I then said to my agent, I'm not going to audition for comedy anymore. And the next day, Plebs came in. And so I went to, and he said, are you sure? And I went, yeah, I'm not, I'll meet him. Mm. So I met Sam and the casting director. And then Sam said, so can we read? And the casting director went, oh, no, she doesn't. You know, so grand. Yeah. She doesn't read. And he just looked like it was a joke. And he went, yeah, but you're here now. So should we read? And I went, no, I don't want to read. And I thought, well, I left and I thought, well, I haven't got that. Yeah. And I got it, but I don't think it set off our relationship particularly well because I think there was a power imbalance to start with. Because I'd gone, I'm not going to read, but I've got the part.
I see, so, actually power imbalance the other way in your favour.
Yeah, slightly. So that set off a slightly sort of rather tricky relationship because people want to come together equally and go, look, creatively, we want to create the best thing together. I don't like the power game here. The best director I've ever worked for, Ben Wheatley, we just had a cup of tea for literally 15 minutes. So I had to go and get a train. We talked about everything, but not really the film.
Wow. Yeah.
And then I went, oh, God, I've got to go. What shall I? And we talked about everything, politics, you know, children, golf courses, crazy things. And I said, what should we do? And he went, well, you just say yes. And I went, yes. And it was just so wonderful. And now that doesn't happen very much.
Well, the thing is, you've proved your mettle, haven't you? Like time and time over with such different diverse characters. It's like, yeah, I pretty much I've got them in my roster of skills.
People still want you to read. I still think, like, I think actresses of 80 still have to read. Yeah. Who are well known.
Yeah. Why is that?
I don't know. It's a strange thing. I would read with somebody for drama. I've done less straight drama and film. It feels more like, yes, let's see if this is the sort of character you want. Let's see if we can. Basically, they want to see if they can direct you. If you can take direction, you're not too spiky. You're amenable and you're good. I want her to be more vulnerable. I want her to be bigger. I want her to be smaller. So that's fine. Let's see if we can work. But yeah, if it's a comedy show, you can look up. There's about 1,000 sketches of me. Maybe you could just see that.
Yeah.
What about theatre? Would you audition and read for theatre?
Yes. Pretty much every theatre I have. I've been offered theatre straight off, and that's great. But say with the Mamet play, someone was reading in for John Malkovich. Obviously, he wasn't there. And David Mamet was just very kind of big character. And I had a temperature of like 102 and I was almost crying in the cafe opposite and I phoned my agent. She just sent me a sort of strong arm.
Oh, yeah. Strong arm emoji.
Don't tell them you're sick. You know, just get in there and do it. And he said that my CV, he said, it says here on your CV that you're a ventriloquist. I was like, obviously my agent is just sending out random jobs that I've never done and skills that I don't have.
We weren't recording. Can you do your drip for the listeners?
Oh, I mean, how good is that, guys? That wasn't a sound effect.
I'll teach you how to do that later. You see, if you come off social media, you too will be able to make a drip noise because you'll spend hours that you would be just texting perfecting the drip.
Yeah. I'm worried I'll become too weird. Like, you know, the things you start noticing when you come off social media, like, oh, there's a plug socket there I never saw before.
I think you should become that person.
I think I become like really introspective and navel gazing and just like, I don't know.
No, I think probably the opposite because I think as you type your virtual self and send it out into the world, it's a very weird self that you're sending out.
Yeah.
So actually the authentic self is somebody who's maybe having a walk by herself, you know, looking at a little bird in the tree
or
a plug socket.
Yeah.
Did you guys listen to that thing this morning on the radio about how narcissists are actually happier? Even if you do become navel-gazing, I mean, at least you'll be happier.
Everybody else, fuck you, everyone else. Yes. I'm happy. Oh, that's funny. But I love that you don't feel the pressure. Like, so I had a conversation. I was at a wedding last night, of all things, on a Monday. Clearly an actor's wedding. and I was speaking to this girl and she was like, yeah, I'm started, you know, developing my Instagram account because I want to be taken seriously as an actor. And part of me, like, my heart sank a bit because I was like, is that really a prerequisite to show your worth? Like, how many people follow you? A, you can buy followers. And B, I don't think how engaging your posts are very indicative of how talented you are or good at your job.
Yeah. I think maybe it's a bit newer thing that Insta followers are something that sometimes people ask before in an audition, don't they?
Yeah, I think so. At least they go and do background check on you.
Has that ever been asked to you, like, how many followers?
I mean, I don't have that many auditions.
I would be hindering myself, if anything. I reckon I would do better to be off it, in fact, because I think you either need enough for them to be like, oh, should be worth casting, or it's better if it's like, oh, she doesn't have social media.
Also, like,
so there we go. Once again, I probably should get off it.
Yeah. It's funny as well when you realise you go to develop these things and put, like, a funny thing out there. And then for me, I personally spend, like, an hour going, oh, God, I misrepresented myself. And then actually, like, I don't really want to share that much about myself. Like, yeah.
It's such a waste of creative time. It literally, you might as well just, I mean, I just find it so depressing. Because we women, as, you know, are silent anyway and have been through the generations. It's now up to us to actually be the mouthpiece. So we need to think about what form we do that in. It isn't taking pictures of ourselves and it isn't sending out our perfect lives. It's sort of being able to be vulnerable together and being empowering to young women who are suffering from anxiety. The anxiety spike through how people look, women taking knives to their faces. Oh, it's absolutely appalling what's happened through social media. Now, obviously, it's very good politically for certain things, but I also think it does, you know, if you want to go on a march, you're going to hear about it.
Yeah.
You know, I do hear about the marches I want to go on. I don't just press the, you know, sign this petition button. I'd much rather get my spray painter go down and graffiti something.
Yeah.
Because that's what we did in the 80s. Yes. It's a bit like, let's go back to something a bit more grassroots and a bit more angry.
Yeah.
And you know, my daughter and I want to go down with our spray cans to the, what I feel is horrible is all the dental aesthetic, facial aesthetic places that are suddenly grown up like spores throughout the city, everywhere. And in all the new builds, instead of having a laundrette and a fishmonger, they've got Botox, then dental, then smile clinic, then body clinic. And it's all pictures of cellulite next to pictures of lips. So this is bad. This is really bad. So we want to go and do ticks and crosses. And
so what have you ever been sort of reprimanded for that by the police? Or
I've been caught on camera a couple of times, but they've not taken it further.
Great. Was this when you first, because I read that you joined a group called Violence Against Women?
Women Against Violence.
Women Against Violence.
WAVL, terrible against name.
Women. WAVL. Definitely the wrong way around. Yeah. WAVL. And that was when you came out of Manchester Uni.
Yeah.
And you went, was it Westminster Bridge that you went and graffitied?
Yes. We used to do the big posters at Vauxhall, you know, that were like car posters with a naked woman on it.
Right, yeah.
And draw a man sort of fucking the exhaust pipe and, you know, that's...
Oh, God, amazing.
Because... And also we would always complain to the Advertising Standards Authority about adverts that we found upsetting. Or you know, it really is bad for young boys to be looking at certain adverts and to be on the tube by yourself with a huge... And we made amazing strides in that all the sort of sexist advertising on the tubes were sort of taken off and then it's all crept back in. So if you're on a tube station, that, you know, assaults on British Rail and on public transport has gone up.
Yeah, have gone up.
You know, hugely, because you're on your own and the advertising is there and it's often women with virtually nothing on.
What decade did it get good at, better in, at least, before it went worse?
It got
again?
It got really good. So I joined in 85 and then I would say from 85 to 90... We were constantly sending letters to the ASA, and they always thought I was a man with my name Dune.
Oh, right, yeah.
Dear Mr. McKinney, well, we're sorry that you feel upset. We've you know, we feel that this is actually appropriate, and we anyway. It was much more the age of letters, Guardian's Woman's Page, you know, that call up Radio 4, and then I would say it slowly sort of crept back in with the Ladette, you know, the sort of Lad Mag, loaded that the beginning of that. It was like men reclaiming their right to have pictures of women.
Right. Yeah. So what's like the 90s or something?
Yeah, more like the 90s. And then, you know, then we managed to get rid of Page Three. So the No More Page Three campaign took a good like 3 to 5 years. And now you have got Page Three, but you've got, you know, you've got women.
Yeah.
But not always.
Yeah.
Because they sneak them back in.
So. Yeah. I mean, this actually segues really nicely onto the stuff that we wanted to talk about.
Obviously, firstly, just to say, to reiterate that this podcast is in partnership with Comedy 50/50, which addresses the gender imbalance in comedy.
Great.
So that's very much the sort of behind-the-scenes stuff in terms of really kind of the writing and the development of things, trying to find parity across the board. Mm. But you obviously, you had Body Count Rising, which was a BBC radio programme, which, guys, you can still listen to on BBC Sounds, even though it came out a couple of years ago.
That's brilliant. Yeah. See, that's when I like technology.
Oh, yes, so good. Yeah. It's a great programme where you talk about essentially violence against women on screen and this and sort of examining the trend in our TV culture of rape and ritualistic murder of women. And the audiences really seem to kind of lap it up.
Mm.
I mean, do you think that's changed since? Because I think it was 2016 that you did that. Do you think that the culture shifted at all since then?
Someone sent me a rather depressing thing about Netflix and looked at a sort of percentage of what shows had violence against women in them, and it was quite high still. No, I don't think it's changed very much.
Really?
No. I mean, I don't know. I don't watch a lot of television, obviously. I've only seen one box set, which I did enjoy. it was fun, but I should have read a book. But there's still a lot of violence against women on screen, and there's still rape as entertainment is still very, very prevalent.
Mm. What, so obviously, I actually haven't listened to the Radio 4 programme yet, but I'm absolutely going to listen to it now, because when I was reading about this yesterday, about this programme that you've done, it resonated so strongly with me, because there were shows that I really enjoyed watching because I thought they were really exciting plots, but I stopped watching them because I could not stand the violence to women, and I got really angry, and I was like, this is good television, but I can't watch it because I cannot watch this. So it was things like Luther and stuff that I had to start watching, what was the other one? Oh yes, so Game of Thrones, and a friend of mine, a female friend, said, oh no, stick with it, because like the nudity gets a bit less and there are some strong women in it. And I was like, I'm not going to make myself stick with something
because you can't unsee it, exactly. That's the thing. Those things are real little mind worms that debilitate us as women from actually creating stuff that is, because it just makes you feel a victim and b disempowered and profoundly kind of end of something like that. I don't want to see a woman pulled down the stairs by her hair. To me, that's as bad. You know, there's a brilliant actress I worked with on a Ben Wheatley film, and I was like, oh great, she's in this, you know. I turned on the thing, and the next thing, she was being beaten to a pulp in the back of a van. And I was like, oh my god, this brilliant young actress is what's happened. And the reason I wrote Body Count Rising is I was on Plebs and I was talking to the two young girls who were in it, and both of them had done rape scenes and they were 25.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my god. And we ended up all crying talking about their experiences on set, which I put into Body Count Rising.
So one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and you probably do address it in the programme, is, so when I was complaining about Luther in these shows and stuff, a friend of mine, a male friend, said, the thing is, I think it's difficult because these are crime television dramas, essentially. So what they're doing is they want it to be realistic, and they're showing what actually happens in real life. So that's why it is the way that it is. And then my argument was, well, that's just a vicious circle. It's self-perpetuating. Yeah. So we're watching it on screen, and then we're ending up with more of it in real life.
Yeah.
Is that something that you discuss, and do you think there's a solution to that?
Yeah, I sort of do discuss that. There are certain people like Michael Winterbottom who say it's morally right to show challenging films. So it's morally our job to show graphic violence. Well, no, it isn't. Mm. It's our job to take a break from graphic violence. We don't need to see it. Let's be like the Greeks. Let's have it off stage. Let's have Medea killing her children, not in front of everybody, but off stage, and coming back with her hands all bloody. We don't need to see graphic violence. There's been an orgy of it, from fetishizing dead bodies to women as victims to women in, you know, chased through woods. But it's the violence, the violent rapes, and the violent, well, even just the casual violence, like, as you say, being pulled down the stairs by your hair.
Yeah.
Just anything that brutalises anyone, male or female, is not cool in this culture of extreme violence. Look at the boys who are getting killed on our street. It's all tied in.
Yeah.
Macho, you know, chauvinistic, misogynistic rap lyrics feeding into a culture that's killing young black boys on the street. That is really, really bad. So, and that ties in with, I wouldn't watch Game of Thrones. I've got several very feminist friends who love it. I wouldn't tell them, you know, I wouldn't say, oh, I can't talk to you because you, but don't talk to me about Game of Thrones or, and then I remember talking to some young boys about that and saying, if it was a lot of men getting raped, or they go, oh, there is a man who gets raped in it. Well, what if it was mostly men getting raped?
Yeah.
It would not be on television. The men would not, they would be profoundly uncomfortable. Men don't want to see nudity. When do you ever see cocks? And never.
Yeah.
And you see completely naked women and men in suits. You see raddled old detectives shagging beautiful young 24-year-old sidekick casting girls. Still. On TV, still commissioned. Why do we want to watch that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think there's a case to say that if there was more equality across the board in terms of the writers' rooms and having more, I'm not saying that men are more predisposed to write violent scenes against women in terms of the writing process, but if there was more equality in the room, that these things may even out a little more and may reduce in terms
I would
of
really
violence.
Hope so, because it is women who are also commissioning violent programmes and who are saying it's our right to, you know, be truthful about these things, and they really have to take a serious look at what they're doing, because it's profoundly affecting the culture that we're in.
Yeah.
To have programs that are very, very successful that are mostly about violence.
Yeah.
I don't think men particularly want to write violent scenes no. against women. I think it's just become what they do to make money. And yeah. women write it as well. There are women novelists who hate my crime writers, who hate what I'm saying. Mm. They think that I'm a complete sort of prudish, you know, because I was like, well, why don't we just call a halt and have a, why don't we just say, let's have a year of no violence against women in our, especially watching it. I mean, books, I just feel on TV and film, it's so easy for children to see it. I remember once, my daughter, it was 9 o'clock, it was just past the watershed, and she was in the sort of TV room, and it was a dinner party, and I was in the other room, and suddenly I walk in and there was like an anal rape going on. I can't describe how, and she was 11, and I remember thinking, she can't unsee that now.
No, no.
And my little girl, who I've brought up and fed, you know, mashed avocado to, is now suddenly
yeah.
suddenly seen this horrible thing, and it's so prevalent,
yes.
sort of everywhere. And the same with porn, obviously, that's very accessible.
Yeah, totally.
So yes, I think, in answer to your question, yes, I think it would be fantastic to have a much more gender equal writer's room for comedy as well, because it all feeds into the
yes,
culture.
Yes, definitely,
comedy as well,
definitely. And I suppose the responsibility also lies, of course, with the producers and the broadcasters as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I was going to ask, what about the viewers? Do you think there's enough power a viewer has just to turn off the programmes? Do you think if enough people do that, it would sort of make a difference?
Well, what's upsetting, as you say, is that people seem to really enjoy, you know, like I remember sitting in a sauna in Glasgow, and these two quite straight older women were going, oh, I'm really looking forward to the fall tonight. And I was like, oh yeah, really? I mean, you listen to the program if you want to hear what I think about the fall. I think that's very, very dangerous, that kind of TV. Sort of sadomasochistic, mixed up with men, you know, women liking men being violent.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think these women were just watching it because he was quite handsome, wasn't he? And not seeing the repercussions
for
particularly younger girls. They're not going to be, you know, affected perhaps mentally by that, but I think it causes anguish and torment and depression.
Oh, 100%. And it can also reinforce an unconscious bias. Like, I know personally, if I'm walking down the street late at night and I see a man, my mind immediately goes to, he's going to attack me. And of course, as part of your animal brain, it's kind of sensible to think, be on your guard, be aware. But then there's the other part of my brain that it probably wouldn't be going to such a heightened, paranoid, adrenaline-fueled state if I hadn't been watching programmes like that, which reinforce the idea that I'm probably going to get attacked because of the way I was born.
And the way that you're dressed and that you're a victim.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You want women to be able to walk at night and get out of their houses and to, you know, and to not be quiet. That's what we want.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
All the wild women roving the streets.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's interesting. I think that's probably why a political drama often appeals, because it's exciting, but you don't have the violence, which is found in so many other dramas.
Yes, I love a thriller. Yeah. My God, what I can't watch is really depressing. Like I was saying to people, what shall I watch on Netflix now I've got it? You know, what shall I...
Succession, but it's not on Netflix.
Succession.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. Obsessed. Again, that's
on telly.
Media.
It's on
Family.
Sky, and it's on Now TV. You'll have to get another subscription to Now TV, but it's honestly worth it. Do the free trial. It's incredible.
Okay.
About the Murdoch media mogul kind of family. That's kind of what it's based on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's lovely to watch really well done and well acted TV. And when people realise that that's actually what people really enjoy, the violent stuff, I would really hope, would just start to get less and less.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Even those things where women get revenge and they go, well, it's great because she then cuts his cock off. You go, but then you've also seen her rape. You know, that's not good. That doesn't make it better for me.
No.
So talking about the shift in culture, or hoping to shift culture, I think Smack the Pony, obviously, we've got to talk about it. I mean, it was a cult classic. It's amazing. It did change the culture at the time. And because you were allowing women to be clowns without talking about, you know, really stereotypically female-oriented things like periods and chocolate and, you know... although there is an amazing, obviously, the recurring theme of hair that comes throughout. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But, I mean, also, can I just say that you swinging around a lamppost is ingrained into my mind.
Funny enough, I was just thinking about that yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, having to stand on a street and lap dance a sort of lamppost with my shopping.
Oh, my God.
It's pretty
so
empowering.
Good.
Yeah,
did you take lessons to do that? Because
Because
I did pole dancing lessons for like 1 week and I was like, this hurts too much.
Yeah.
But you had
workout,
the moves.
I think it was just from, you know, being a kid and doing that thing around the bars. I used to love gymnastics. I think it was just learning how to swing around a pole.
Did you have as much fun doing that show as it looked? And do you feel like it sort of has changed the way that women are perceived in comedy on our
screens? If only there were more programmes like it now.
Mm.
That saddens me. There aren't quite as many. There's certainly not clowny. There's not many physical... humoured.
No,
that's true.
I mean, obviously Motherland is brilliant, but it's to do with character and psychology.
Yes.
It's wonderful and brilliant. I love it. But I want to see more women being, you know, being more physical.
Yeah.
So it's a shame it hasn't sparked off in a way that Bridesmaids also didn't spark off a sort of whole raft of women films about, I mean, that's hilarious
Yeah.
So you've got these two things that sort of were iconic, but they didn't go anywhere. And so that's really sad, because I think our culture really needs it. I think women the amount of times I get asked about Smack the Pony and is it coming back and will you do it again? And
is
kind of annoying, because it's not coming back. We've sort of met a few times and discussed, should we do a narrative? Should we do sketches? Should we do a complete remake?
Mm.
And it's never quite happened.
Why? I mean, like... is it that people just specifically want you guys and you're like, it's like a holy kind of protected kind of, it's just for these three? Or is, do you know what I mean? Like, why, like people like Lazy Susan and other sort of sketch comedy groups, why isn't there the space for
why aren't they on TV? Yes, exactly, because I haven't been to see stand-up for ages.
Mm. Yeah.
And I know there's a lot of good women doing shows at like Soho Theatre and a lot of great shows at Edinburgh. So obviously you get the breakout shows like Fleabag, who then get on TV, but... maybe that's now more the way in.
I think
your Edinburgh show.
Lazy Susan managed to get, I think it was a half hour,
though,
or was it a short, maybe 20 minutes on BBC after. I mean, they've been going for like a long time now and they're brilliant, and they did finally get their first TV thing, I think, as a sketch double act, as it were. But it's not a regular series by any means.
I think sketch comedy has sort of died, though.
I think maybe it's partly the trend in sketch comedy.
Yeah.
But with Smack the Pony, because it was so well acclaimed in terms of the awards in the States, more than the UK, because it got Emmys but not BAFTAs, was there ever an appetite when the States said, right, we'll take you and we'll go and do it then, you know, and do more
of it?
We
didn't sort of plough into the States
because
we were just so busy, because it takes a long time to write it.
Yeah. Mm.
So we were literally locked in a basement for sort of, till we couldn't bear it anymore, because we would film our improvisations and then we'd often have writers in the room. So it was a very long process about talking about stupid shit that had happened to us. Like not kind of big women's issues, but like, you know, I sucked a glass onto my face and couldn't get it off, and my friend was talking about getting cancer, and it was like, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Sort of just clowning stuff.
She did that the other day about hot drinks. She was like, I drink my tea too fast, I'm going to get cancer. I was like, don't think so.
I'm going to heat up the mercury in my mouth, but
So the process then, you'd gone in a room, you'd say like observations that had happened to you, you'd then improvise it, is that right?
And we would often get... some material that had been from, you know, Smith and Joe, it had been rejected from other male comedy shows.
Oh, yeah.
So we would get the sort of off-cut orphan material of like two men, bomb disposal experts. And they would just sort of cross it out and go two women. And of course it was so often written by men for men. So that was interesting. We sometimes reworked something we thought had a nub of a good idea, but we made the straight person the funny person. We made the funny person.
Yeah.
So we just, because we'd always been feeds for men's, we'd all been in comedy before, and been teacher, dolly bird, receptionist, you know, not been the lead. We'd been the feeds.
Yeah.
So it was really good for us to be able to make the straight one the feed. But what we would do is we would sit and chat about stuff that made us laugh, and then we would just get up and try and do something about that. Right. Sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't.
How do you find writing with other people? Because I think not everyone can do it. It takes a real skill.
Well, we would impro. We would. Sally was very good at writing stuff down on a computer, and then we often had sometimes one or two writers in the room, and the producer was very good at kind of going, let's do it, but let's change the angle a bit. Let's take the comedy out of it. So we didn't do issue-based stuff ever.
Right.
We never did sort of diets, periods, chocolate, men. We just did stuff that was happening to us. At that time, I had two small children and they didn't have children.
Yeah.
So we were having different experiences. It was probably good.
Yeah.
And it took a long time. Like, sometimes we would work on one sketch that we knew had something in it, just didn't quite take off. And then we'd have to sort of go, I don't know why that's not working. Film it. And then go, no. And then go, oh, I've got a brilliant idea for that now. And Sally would come in and go, I know what we do. We just completely turn it back to front. So it's about sitting with things sometimes.
Mm.
It's not a fast process.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of, a lot of long days of maybe one sketch coming out of it. And sometimes just, wow. And then, you know, when we did video dates, that was great because on our first series, we had like 15 that we liked on paper. And we didn't rehearse. We hadn't rehearsed them, and we just had like wigs. And we've got 2 hours left. Let's do some video dates quickly. Go and put a wig on and choose one.
Oh wow!
So you're like, I'm Sally. I'm 30. I'm into, you know, I'm fun to be with. I'm fun to be, you know. And then we would just start coming, and that was great. So we did this sort of production line, and the quickness of it made it good. I think.
There
wasn't
sense.
Too much time to think and rehearse it. So it's a bit more improv.
So out of, this is a potentially hard question, but out of all the characters that you've played, and I don't mean in Smack the Pony, I mean across your entire career, a whole myriad of different characters, do you have one that you, okay, firstly, do you have one that you enjoyed playing the most? And then the second part to that question, is there one that sort of resonated with you the most that maybe taught you something about yourself?
That's such a hard question. If I could add up the number of characters I've played, it would run into hundreds.
Okay, what's one you've enjoyed the most?
Oh, my God.
Is there one that just springs into your mind that you think... Because it's so difficult because it's sort of joined up with, like, the process and the directing and everything else, isn't it? It's very hard to detach them, but...
I'm trying to think of theatres, probably... Do you know, I actually can't answer that question. I'm finding it. I mean, I love playing Jane Plough in Toast because it's like payback to all the women who turned me down throughout my career.
Yeah.
I just put the phone down on me because I used to work for a co-op and have to call up 30 casting agents on a Monday afternoon. It was so hideous.
Oh, really?
You know, sort of power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that. You know, I've really enjoyed theatre that I've done. I did a play in Chichester with Tom Hollander about mental health that, you know, not many people saw, but I think it was I did a really good job in it.
What was it called, that one?
Me and My Friend.
Okay. No, I didn't
know
that.
Before. And, you know, there's been some theatre that I think has been, and I enjoyed doing, I did a one-woman show about my son's cancer.
Yes.
Called Prima Donna.
Mm.
And I played a lot of characters in that, and one particular woman who was so angry and broken about her daughter's cancer that had come back and was making her daughter this sort of, you know, perfect food. But she was sort of furious and broken. It was tragic, but very funny as well. You know, I sort of enjoy that really sort of fine line between dark, oh my God, her daughter's maybe going to die, but she sort of hates her daughter because she has to cook her food and the fucking cancer's come back, but I'm making her steamed broccoli anyway. was those sort of that I love it when it's right on the edge of dark.
Do you think this is a separate question, but on that note, do you think there are some things that are off limits for comedy, or at least, actually, perhaps I should phrase it like this, off limits if you haven't personally experienced it?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Like, can you talk about...
Could you have done that show if your child hadn't had cancer?
Yeah. Could someone else play that part?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. It's that whole thing about should Daniel Day-Lewis have done my left foot?
Right, yeah.
Mm. You know, should good actors take on disabled jobs? Should men play women?
Yeah.
You know, sorry, you haven't had the wealth of my, you know, pain and sadness.
Yes,
and, you know,
but you're
going to play a woman. I don't know. It's very difficult. I think it's to do with art. I think it's to do with how much integrity goes into a project, how you cast it, and whether you think you have got the credentials to be able to take it on.
Yeah. And so Prima Donna was under comedy, was it, in the ratio? I mean, that was the...
Yes, I mean, it was funny, but it was sad. And so people did laugh and cry, which to me is
my favourite thing. Yeah, favourite combo, yeah.
And especially when my son actually came to see the show and got up in the curtain call, then everyone was just sobbing.
Yeah. Oh, wow. How old was he at the time?
He was 9 when he got cancer, and he was 11 when he sort of was out of hospital, and then it took a good few years to... So he came when he was about 14.
Gosh.
Wow.
Yeah, that was excellent.
And did you need that, clearly needed that amount of time to be able to have a bit of space from it, process it, be able to turn it into something that you could share with people?
I mean, I don't know. When you write stuff, you've got to really want to write it. I didn't want to write... I wasn't thinking, I'm going to write this at all.
Really?
I kept a sort of diary because I just thought, I need to know, I need to remember, I need to just mark this every day, even if it was 2 lines, I would just write. But what I did get is the hospital notes, which they don't normally give you, because people often sue when their kids die, so hospitals don't release the notes.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's really sad, because people are so angry. If they lose a child, they want to sue, you know, them for not doing more, and often they can't do more, and that's it's over. Whereas with Louis, they'd been so amazing that when I did ask, they were like, what's it for? And I said, I think I might put it into a show. And they were like, well, we're worried about that. And I was like, no, I literally want to say how amazing you've been. Mm. You know, the NHS is, Christ almighty, you know, the nurses. So I was able to, and I sat and read through those notes one night. And it must have been how many years after? That's right. I'd got back. I was doing a theatre show. I was hating it. I was doing Lute at the Tricycle, and it was probably too soon to be performing. You know, I was just a bit broken. And I turned on the TV, and Russell Brand was on doing stand-up. And I just looked at Russell Brand. I thought, what gives you the right to be so confident? And I just felt angry that I wasn't seeing more women being that confident and talking about their experiences. And I thought, what if I talk about this really dark experience, but I can try and make it funny as well? So I sat with the notes, cried my eyes out, and wrote maybe a paragraph of one of, like, when I first walked into the ward of the cancer ward. And it was awful, but it was sort of funny. It's a bit like an actress going, well, I call my agent, get me out of here, this is the wrong casting, I shouldn't be here. Because you keep thinking, well, this is wrong. Someone's going to come in and say, sorry, it's not, you know, it's a denial thing. So then I just carried on. And then a friend was very good. She read it and she went, no, you, and I developed it, but it didn't happen straight away. I did it with an amazing director. And he went, when we took it into a room, he went, this is too personal. I can't cut any of this. I can't work on this. It's just too personal. So he said, you need to get someone else in to either rework it, look at it. So I got a dramaturg in called Bryony Lavery, an amazing
woman. Oh, wow. Right, yeah.
And she sort of did a pass. And when I read it, I felt chilled because it wasn't me. And I thought, well, this is a confessional show and someone else's. This is not going to... Yeah. So it took a while to find its voice because it was too personal. So she helped me. And then together we shaped it with both of our... We literally turned the whole thing upside down. She taught me a lot about writing.
Yeah.
And yes, so it was probably about how many characters? Yes, it was probably about, I don't know, 12 characters, you know, nurses, doctors, ladies next door, girlfriends, maybe more.
And it was always obvious to you, was it where the humour would come from? Or were you sometimes like, I don't know how to make this funny? Or no, I mean, that in real life.
Yeah, was the objective to make it funny actually at all?
The objective was to show what he'd been through, because so many people think their lives are shit. They really, you know, and I always had the red card after the cancer of like, well, you think your loft conversion is going to give you a nervous breakdown. Let me tell you about my... So I always had this sort of slightly superior kind of, yeah, I've been in a cancer ward. You know, it was this weird thing of the sliding scale of people's suffering. And I suppose I wanted people to understand how a child so bravely goes through that experience, because they're in the moment, they're not thinking, they're not crying because they're thinking about the next chemo that's coming or how sick they've been that day, or there's no self-pity, there's no victimhood, they just get on with it.
Yeah.
And it's utterly awe-inspiring. So it just is, it just sort of breaks open your world of adult neurosis.
Yeah.
So I sort of wanted to do it to go to everyone, look how lucky you are that your life is actually bloody amazing. And then within that, there was obviously I brought in a little bit about how, because I was with my husband at the time, but we ended up breaking up at the end of it. I think it either makes or breaks you. So through that, threaded through that, was also the breakdown. So counselling, so that was quite funny, sitting in counselling, going to my first voiceover, and people sort of going, is he going to, you know, people saying very inappropriate things that are sort of terrible but funny because they don't know what to say. And I'm trying to do a voiceover, you know, without being sick, because I'm suddenly out in the world, and in the world feels very weird.
Mm.
So it was about recovery and redemption and bravery. And it
sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, but I don't think I could do it again.
Right, no, no, I imagine that is absolutely draining.
Of its time.
Yeah.
But it sort of shows you that when you want to write something, I suppose, ask yourself, if, you know, literally, if I was going to die in a year, what would I write? What would be the thing I'd most want to write about if I only had a short amount of time?
Yeah.
And that's...
This, again, leads very nicely onto the when you did Jumpy at the Royal Court. So, funnily enough, I saw that production.
I did too. Years ago. Yeah, it was great.
Did you?
Yeah. So I read a book about playwriting years ago, and in it they interviewed April Dungeness, and she said that she finds herself going time and time again, going back to this theme that she seems to endlessly write about, which is parent and child. And I wondered whether that was what it was that attracted you to doing Jumpy, whether it was that sort of relationship at the heart of it between Tamsin and the I can't remember
Belle.
The name.
Belle Powley.
And actually then, yeah, how you go about picking your roles now that you're doing, if you're not writing them yourself.
Mm. That's brilliant that April is fascinated with that, because we both have had troubled teenage daughter times.
Right, you see that.
Yeah, at the time, I was going through a particularly tricky time with my 15-year-old, who's now 24. And that was... So, I mean, Tamsin used to come and ask me about what had gone on with my daughter, because she was sort of like feeding off my even though I was playing a completely different character, I was playing the actress friend, wasn't I, who's going up for
roles. You weren't having the sort of parent child
no,
role.
I
you were the fun
the
right, sort
but
of
but I
right
actually
role.
Was having that
oh that's really
while
funny.
It was happening, and Tamsin would go, God, what's, you know, like Indy was out all night, couldn't, I was trying to, you know, she went to a rave in Vauxhall, like, she didn't come home, she was whatever, it was a difficult time. It was exactly kind of what was happening in Jumpy. I just thought Jumpy's so amazing because it's so true.
Yes, but cast that way around.
Yeah. Could you have played Tamsin's role then, do you think, at the time when it was so close?
Well, I don't know. I mean, weirdly, because of what had happened with Louis and breakup, my dad died, it was like death, leukemia and divorce. That I then got very ill at the end of Jumpy. At the Royal Court. Pre-West End.
Oh, gosh, wow.
Yeah, I ended up very ill, which I think is a real flag up to anyone dealing with emotional stuff, is that you've got to pay attention to processing pain because it will catch up with you. So it was sort of probably like my form of a sort of breakdown. I had to stop. I ended up in hospital in an isolation ward with everyone within masks. It was a serious kind of pneumonia.
Wow. So you didn't do the West End?
Well, then I pulled out the West End and said, I'm too ill. And they were like, they was just really wanted me to do it. And April would phone me and Nina was phoning me, are you sure you're not well enough? I was like, no way, I can hardly fucking walk. And then I kind of rehabilitated myself. You know, I really worked hard on... And I remember thinking, I was walking in Hastings on the east hill, and I remember thinking, I feel strong for the first time. I think I'm gonna do it, you know. Yeah. And I called them. They were like, we're in auditions for your part.
Oh God!
I was like, oh shit! but I think I can. They were literally about. It was one of those literally light breaking through the cloud moments. They were about to offer it to someone else because they'd hung on and hung on, and like 2 weeks before I'd said no. And then I suddenly could feel my strength coming back. Wow. So I said, yes, I can do it. And they were like, oh, my God. So they had to tell this poor girl who'd come in the second time, he was about to get it. So then I did do it in the West End, and it was much better because I was the one, when I was at the Royal Court, I was getting pretty ill.
Oh, right, interesting. Wow. Yeah, well, you didn't seem ill when I saw you in it, but, you know, obviously.
Well, that dance was...
He used to practically
give me a sort of, you know, asthma attack.
He's very athletic, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the
burlesque.
Yeah, gosh. So So nowadays, then, in terms of what you take, it's like if the part says something to you that you haven't done before, or
well, often it's just to pay the mortgage.
Yeah, sure, that, you know, practically. Yeah,
I love that you say that. No one is honest enough.
Yeah,
about
you have
that.
To pay. I mean, God, I have to take jobs that are just like, oh, really? Do I have to do this? Is a bit. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. How much? Yeah. Yeah.
Double it, and then I'll do it.
Yeah, double it, and I'll do it. Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, it's not. I'm not leafing through scripts going, oh, no, darling, it's not big enough for me. I'm just taking what keeps the wolf from the door and keeps the food on the table. But at the same time, you know, hope better roles are coming in. People are writing better things. I just did a great episode of something called Flack,
which
is about the PR girls, but written by a guy, written by Oliver
Landley or something like that.
Landley. God.
I read about it and
yeah,
I can't remember.
And I just remember the turning up on day one and it being literally a room of like 13 women. I was like, and I just went, thank you.
This amazing. Really good. Yeah,
this
yeah.
is really good.
They made a pilot, didn't they?
Yes.
And then it didn't go to
That's
series.
Right. Yes.
And then it's been remade with. Is it
Anna Paquin?
Yes.
Anna Paquin. And Steve Moyer, who's her husband, is a sort of producer, director, and a really great actress called Lydia, and I can't remember her surname, who's about
Wilson.
To play Duchess of Malfi at the Almeida.
Wow.
It's about three PR girls and their lives. But, you know, that's written by a man and it's very good.
Yeah, oh, right.
I don't sound surprised about that, but it's written some very good women's parts, you know, which is very good.
Yeah.
And are you working on Catherine Ryan's new show as well,
yes.
The Duchess?
Yes.
Brilliant. Are you allowed to talk about that?
Am I? Do you know, I wonder if I am.
It's on your CV.
Yes. I was filming it yesterday. I was dancing in boxer shorts.
You always dance, don't you?
You do. I mean,
it's true. Actually,
when you
maybe
Google
I should
you,
be a dancer.
Well, there's so many references to your physicality, not in like all boobies kind of way, but like as in the way you move, like in loads of articles,
yes, that's
just
true.
About your physical presence. And,
well,
you know.
I think I should have been a dancer because I wanted to be a ballerina, and I was told I was too tall, and then I gave up ballet and cried for weeks. And then I did a bit of contemporary sort of dance. And when I was at Manchester, I did do some dance. I wanted to be a choreographer.
Oh,
I didn't
right.
want to be a stand-up. And then I ended up being a stand-up, so it was kind of weird. But my stand-up was very physical as well.
Yeah, you found ways to
clowny.
Get it in.
Yeah, yeah, so I've always been interested in, yes, bodies. And women don't use their bodies. We're very ashamed of our bodies. And that's even worse now with social media. That's what I hate about it, the shame.
Yeah.
How a woman can take a knife to her face when she's under 60 or 70 is beyond me. It's so sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tragedy. That's what's happening to so many young girls. They're feeling ashamed about their bodies. They think they're disgusting.
Yeah.
And horrible. They're disgusting. Look at that. You know, circles of shame. Blue circles of shame. Mm. Wonky toes, you know, bad knees, scabby, you know, we're all a mess of, you know, it's amazing. We're all just so incredibly different.
Yeah, completely. I was like a sort of mixed bill night on Saturday, and there was actually a guy from LA, sort of like, I guess he was mid-20s, and he read out an essay about how he'd had an eating disorder growing up, because he was like, try growing up in LA just as a normal child, when everyone's got basically looks perfect.
Wow.
And it may be, I'd never considered about, always think of LA as an actor's moving there or being there.
Yeah.
But I forget that like just normal families live in LA and that's the backdrop to your life. If you live there,
yes,
you're just
born
there.
Yes, I went there and no one looked like me of my age.
Right,
I mean, people my age looked 30. It was really weird. I was like, God, is that how...
That's creepy.
How old is that woman?
Yeah.
I mean, she looks... In her soul, you can tell she's older.
Yeah.
She's been through... But her face is like a 30-year-old. It's completely... So that's very
weird.
Odd. It's like you don't... You can't see aging, so you can't see experience. You wouldn't go to her, that person as a wise person, you know, or a...
No.
It's messed up.
That is, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's really odd. Someone who's got so much life experience and not the face to show it.
You'd
be like, sorry, how did you know so much?
Yeah.
When you look 20?
You must have read loads!
And our communication is probably getting worse as well, because if people can't move their faces to... I mean, that's one of the first things apparently you look at when you meet someone for the first time, is the top half of their face.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you involuntarily lift your eyebrows up to do that, oh, hey, I know you kind of greeting.
Yeah.
And it's a way of building a sense of rapport with someone really quickly. If you can't move your forehead because you've got Botox in it or whatever, then I'm sure we are kind of going to gradually over time miss each other on waves of communication.
Yeah. It's true. I actually never thought about that.
So, if you have a piece of advice Don't put a knife to your face.
Yes.
Get off social media.
Yeah, yeah.
For anyone in this industry, and I mean that's kind of loose because obviously there's many different parts to it, but yes. what would you impart as a piece of wisdom?
I would think, really think about what you want to say in the world and how you want to say it, so that if you want to be an actor, what do you want to say? What do you just want someone to give you a good role, and then, or do you want to take it and do something with it that's very personal to you? So I would say, keep a journal, you know, write, and as a woman, don't be quiet. I think we've lost our sense of being wild and having gut reactions, so it's probably very good to spend time in nature by yourself. And the time you think, oh God, look at me, Billy fucking No Mates walking along the beach with my journal, you know, that voice that shames us is too loud.
Yeah.
So have a chat with that voice, you know, go, you know, sit with that voice and go, yeah, but I actually really think that I need to keep going with this. And the voice is going, well, why do you think that? Because you're pretty useless, and there's loads of other people who are better than you. So it's that voice that shames us and makes us stop doing things that is crippling people's ability to be creative. And I think what also saps creativity is social media. So that's a big, broad, sweeping thing, but
there's so many nuggets.
There's a
in there.
Lot of ways to be creative that will then feed into the thing that you present to the world that everyone goes, wow, that's good. You know, we didn't think we were doing anything with Smack the Pony. We thought it was rubbish. So there we are. We were just recording stuff. When we filmed it, nobody laughed. It was an all-male crew. We didn't really know each other that well. It was really not that much fun. And then when it was sort of cut, because it was authentic and it had come from real experience and us sitting around for hours in a room, and it was very well put together by our producer and graded and given, you know, made to look good, we suddenly went, so actually that 4 days we talked about, you know, big shoes really was important.
Yeah.
You know, shoes that are too big and really hurty feet. Isn't a small thing, it's actually an important thing to share. So writing stuff down is quite good, because you realize what your preoccupations are.
Yeah.
And then when you look at those, you go, oh right, there's a theme here, maybe I should, you know, stop trying to do that but do this instead. I've said about 10 things, I think.
No, oh my God, I'm just completely gripped. I feel like this is like
therapy.
Yeah, a little bit, but no, I feel so wholesome.
Shall I be a life coach?
Yes!
Please! In the podcast land.
I don't think we can afford you.
Can I be Lady Life Coach in the SoundCloud of... I don't know. I don't understand.
Oh my God. Up in the clouds.
I'm glad this ethereal world of podcasting sound.
It's just so true that I love it. It's like your advice sums up what I think you're about, even only having met you for an hour, but as in just that idea about, like, you know, what using your opportunity to say what you want to say. And I feel you do that in the work, but also by the sounds of what you've worked on in terms of your activism, you do that, you've used the work as a platform to do that aside from that as well.
The activism is interesting because that came at uni, and then I really didn't do much. I just was having children and being angry and maybe going and graffitiing something and shouting at them. But when I met those girls on Plebs, and the sort of Boise nature, we happened to be staying in an awful hotel that had something called the Candy Bar underneath, which was basically a prostitutes hotel. And the girls were very young and the men were older. And often you'd get into a lift and there would be a young girl. And I just wanted to give them money and go, please run as fast as you can. So the whole thing conspired to me writing an article for the Hay Festival, who had asked me to just go and do a chat about something that I felt powerful. You know, angry about, and I thought, well, it's violence on TV, and so it came to be an article that I wrote in that hotel room on masses of bits of paper, and then I did that at the Hay, and there was quite a small audience, and I remember they were pouring bottles into the bin behind, so it was really hard to hear. So every so often, the massive amount of bottles were going to this bin. And I remember thinking, this is shit, you know, reading in a sort of weird armchair on a stage, reading this script and going, But I remember writing it and feeling incredibly passionate. And then after that, someone had seen it and tweeted. So this is a good thing about social media, I suppose, had tweeted it to someone else. And then someone at the New Statesman wanted to see it. Mm. And then they put it up on the New Statesman.
Wow.
And then it went viral. And then it inspired the radio show. Wow. So that came from talking to two girls in a hotel room about their experiences. And so keeping so now, if I'd been watching a box set, tweeting my daily thing, I might not have done that article.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have had enough time. Or I would have gone, oh, that was awful, wasn't it? Oh, you poor things, you know. Well, you've had to do two rape scenes. Oh, that's awful. Anyway, moving on. But I think time is very important to use well, because that was a really important thing to do, because that radio show has then sparked lots of other things.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to go around speaking about this, but I want to put it into the work that I do, and I want to inspire other younger people and people coming up through the business and people my age to not do those programs.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And to, you know, I've had people call me from read-throughs and go, oh, I don't know what to do.
Oh,
I'm, yeah. I haven't worked for fucking 3 years. I'm absolutely desperate to do this, but there's a horrific scene in it. What shall I do? And I go, well, I can't advise you, but this is what I would do. Yeah. I would talk to the director and say, do we need to have this? And if he goes yes, then maybe you don't do it.
Yeah.
You mm-hmm. know, so it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Actually, when you're in the front line, you're in a read through and you're like, oh, I've got this, he's an amazing director. He's got this, you know, zhuzhy character. I've got a great part. What do I do? That's the hard thing.
Absolutely.
You know, and to say to them on set, I don't want to drop the towel. I don't want to wear the body stocking. I've said I don't want to show anything, but when you're there, they want you to. So it's the letting. That's why the Me Too movement has been a great, a great thing, because it's protected people on set and off set. Women. I was about to go into drama schools and talk to young girls to say what you don't need to do in the business.
Yes,
and the Me Too movement has sort of allowed, has made me not have to do that, because I think I would hope that younger actresses and actors would know not to go into a hotel room with a producer by themselves.
And I think producers also would be much more cautious about doing that now.
100%. So, Dune, just to round everything off, this has been amazing. We do have one final question.
I think Dune's answered that. I think it's the same as the question you just asked.
Well, it could be slightly different.
Okay,
let's see, because that's advice to people, but this is about herself and what she's learned. If there's one thing that your career in comedy has taught you about life, what is it?
Oh, gosh, that's hard.
Demanding yet more great answers from you.
Comedy. To not be afraid of looking stupid or ugly or looking, you know, fail again, fail better. I think with Smack the Pony, being able to dress up and look hideous in most of my... people found that, people were really like, wow, I mean, God, you looked awful in that. You know, I'd be like, yeah. And then what I'll do is you'll see me in my nice frock and then I'll look really pretty.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so don't be afraid to look not perfect.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, and actually fail, you know, really do something that doesn't work.
Yeah.
In the old days of stand-up, we used to literally go on stage with pieces of paper, and it was a bit like, if the audience didn't like it, no one booed you off, but there would just not be much of a reaction and you'd go, okay, that doesn't work. Okay, let's try that. Let's try the next thing. And with Smack the Pony, we played all the sketches into a live audience and we cut the ones that they didn't laugh at.
Right, yeah. Mm. I mean, there's the barometer.
So it doesn't matter that people don't laugh. It doesn't mean you're shit. It just means that doesn't quite work or it's too much of an in-joke. So I think, be very willing to fail.
That's a great point.
Fail and don't be afraid to look shit. Amazing.
thank you so much.
It's been brilliant.
Pleasure.
And you're a natural at podcasts, so definitely do more.
I'm never doing anything but this podcast again and again.
Yes. GreatBigOwl.com.
Hi, Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.